Chapter 2. Arthur yawns widely. He stayed up late last night to watch a political documentary on the BBC, which was cleverly scheduled to tie in with the upcoming government vote. It was basically an account of political attitudes towards magic in post-war Britain that focused mainly on the outlooks of the Fellowship Party and the Integrity Party. Uther would have chided him for watching a show on the BBC, a news outlet apparently dripping with pro-magical bias, but Arthur had found it fascinating. Historically, neither of the main two parties were known to support magical advancement, but in the early 90s, the Fellowship Party selected Rowena Annis as their new leader, and she immediately set out a policy of support and protection for magical citizens in the Fellowship Manifesto. There was bitter opposition from members of her own party and Integrity politicians alike, and some claimed it was this policy that prevented the Fellowship Party from winning a popular election until 2007. But others argued that the time had simply caught up with Annis's foresight, pointing to the shock landslide victory that she won in 2007, which was repeated with ease in 2012. It was only now, in her second term, that Annis had finally made a push for the idea she had first proposed nearly 20 years before. A bill to end compulsory microchipping of magicals. Unsurprisingly, the Integrity Party was fully opposed. Unfortunately for Annis, despite having a clear majority in the House of Commons, some of her own party were unwilling to back the legislation. They claimed it was too soon, that it might alienate more moderate voters who preferred the gradual integration of magicals into society. The smattering of other parties in the House of Commons divided down traditional lines, the right-wingers opposing the bill and the left-wingers largely backing it, with the exception of the right-wing libertarians, who claimed microchips were a breach of individual freedoms. So it was that the current predictions for the vote were on a knife edge, with neither side looking to have much advantage. On a purely selfish level, Arthur is unhappy about this. If the vote was sure to go one way or the other, his father might stop badgering him and the rest of the staff to campaign better. Arthur's been put on a deeply monotonous task of ringing past supporters of Arkstone to ask them to lobby their MP to vote on the bill. 7 years with the company, and this is the most responsibility he's ever been entrusted with. He should be grateful for the step up from errand boy, but Arthur would honestly rather be out in the fresh air making deliveries than interacting with possibly the most tedious members of the public he's ever encountered. So, when he gets called into his father's office first thing Monday morning, he's pretty sure he knows what the meeting's going to be about. He's not calling enough people, he's not persuasive enough, his numbers are down compared to everyone else in the office. He assumes he's in for yet another lecture about how he's doing everything badly, as usual. In the end, he's both right and wrong. Uther does want to talk about the vote, but he doesn't want to tell Arthur off. Ah, come in, son, have a seat. It's a warmer greeting than he's received in a while, and Arthur can't help returning the rare smile his father is directing at him. Owain, one of the guys from the Arkstone Surveillance Department, is already sat down, and Gilly, Uther's perpetually terrified assistant, is hovering in the background. After sending Gilly to make coffee, Uther steeples his fingers under his chin and turns to Arthur. Arthur guiltily stops fiddling with the ring on his finger and rests his hand on his lap. The ring is his mother's, and Uther hates to be reminded of it. How are things going on the fourth floor? Good, good. I hope to make about 40 more calls today. Never mind all that now. I have decided we need to take a more active role in shaping the outcome of the upcoming vote. Arthur nods, trying to look keen for whatever menial task his father is no doubt about to assign to him. The Magicals have been tirelessly campaigning for this vote, and they've got their four little spies firmly ensconced in the House of Commons. There were currently four elected MPs with magic. Mordred Barrett, Margot Prynne, Cara Hartley Croft, and Julius Borden. Arthur had heard, on several occasions and in great detail, his father's specific objections to each one of them. If they pass this thing, there's nothing to stop them from trying for the Magical Protection Act next year. Annis had made no bones about her desire to pass an act that would introduce sweeping powers of protection to end legislative discrimination against magicals in all areas of society. Arthur knows it's Uther's worst nightmare. The act would make the majority of Arkstone's activities illegal. It would, undoubtedly, spell the end of the company. We can't let them get to that point. If the microchipping bill goes down in flames, they won't even attempt to pass the Protection Act. That's why we need to make a statement. Something that says we won't let this country be blackmailed and bullied by a small pressure group of dangerous malcontents.
Right, so a press release, or...
Arthur wishes he hadn't made such a feeble suggestion when he sees the faint glimmer of pity in Owain's eyes. Uther exhales irritably.
Something a bit bigger than that. Something a lot bigger, in fact.
He pins Arthur with a look.
And I want you to handle it for me.
Arthur sits up a little straighter.
Certainly, he says. Whatever you need.
Uther gives him a thin smile.
I'm glad to hear it, Arthur, because what I need is for you to kidnap someone.
Were it not for the fact that his father never, ever made jokes, Arthur would have assumed his leg was being pulled.
What?
He asks and cringes to hear his own incredulous tone. Uther regards him coolly.
Don't be uncouth, Arthur. Say, I beg your pardon. And I believe I was perfectly clear. I need you to overpower and restrain someone, then take them to the house on the moors and hold them as a hostage for a few weeks.
Why?
To delay, or better yet, stop the vote.
How would the hostage be related to the vote? Arthur asks weakly.
Your target is a man with great influence within the magical community. We'll send an anonymous ransom note that clearly states to the magicals, and anyone else who might care, that their little friend will die unless the vote is cancelled, or at the very least postponed.
Arthur knows he's far from the most intelligent person in the room, but there seems to be a few holes in this plan. Uther's looking at him forbiddingly, but he can't help speaking up.
What good will it do us if the vote is postponed or cancelled? Won't they just reschedule it when we release the hostage?
By then, we'll have had time to set an alternative plan in motion, one that will bolster the No campaign significantly enough to ensure the bill is voted down.
But won't the hostage tell the truth? Unless...
Arthur breaks off to stare at his father.
You're not going to tell me to kill him.
Arthur can't do that. He won't do that. Surely his father would never go that far, not for the sake of a vote.
Don't be so melodramatic, Arthur. Of course I won't.
We've made alternative arrangements for ensuring the hostage's silence. Owain will go through them with you in a minute.
All right, it's just...
Arthur hesitates, trying to avoid offense.
I don't quite understand how this will achieve our aims.
We've worked out all the details, believe me, Uther says dismissively. This plan's been a long time in the making.
But what if Arthur?
Uther cuts in, and the world-weary tone is so familiar that Arthur cringes automatically.
Why don't you let us worry about the big picture? Your part is to focus on the kidnapping.
It's not just the tone, it's the look Uther accompanies it with, one that Arthur's seen so many times before. The look that says,
you're embarrassing me. The look that says, you always embarrass me.
Right, Arthur says. Focus. That's what he's best at. He can't deal with too many things at once. He's most efficient when someone just tells him what to concentrate on.
Like a trained dog, a malicious little voice whispers inside him.
He should be happy, technically. His father's calling the debt in after all this time. This is Arthur's chance to redeem himself, to finally be free of the guilt and shame of what he nearly caused all those years ago. He nods, makes a show of looking eager.
So,
Who's the target?
Owain picks up an envelope and shakes out several photos onto the table in front of Arthur, all of the same man.
This is Merlin Emrys, and he's at the heart of everything.
It's a dramatic statement, but looking at the photos, Arthur can't help but feel a little underwhelmed. Merlin Emrys appears to be a lanky, badly dressed man in his early 20s, with a crow's nest of dark hair and a sharp elfin face. He seems to only own one pair of jeans, black, skinny, and a variety of long-sleeved t-shirts paired with brightly colored scarves, and, bizarrely, fingerless gloves. All in all, he resembles a third-year drama student more than a man of great influence. His doubts must show on his face because Uther leans over to jab his finger down on the table.
Don't let his appearance fool you. He's the advisor to basically every influential magical in British society. He's been a behind-the-scenes agitator on every piece of policy that's come out of the Institute in the last year and a half.
The Institute was officially named the Institute for the Protection and Promotion of Magical Persons, but it had become prominent enough to be denoted by a single-word moniker. It was the organizing ground for essentially all magic-related advocacy in the UK, and Arthur had been listening to Uther rant about it for as long as he can remember. In an attempt to head off another Institute-themed tirade at the pass, he quickly asks,
"So, what's his bio?"
25 years old, born in Brighton to Hunith Emrys, née Chatsworth, and Balinor Emrys, a magical who walked out on the family when Merlin was 10, since deceased. Microchipped at 5 as standard, attended local primary and secondary school, brilliant GCSEs, average A-levels, left school at 18, and that's pretty much it until last year.
Arthur frowns. What do you mean that's it? What about the 6 years in between?
We don't know, Uther says grimly. Merlin Emrys's microchip stopped transmitting 3 months after he received his A-level results. It's been dead since then.
Arthur gapes. How is that possible?
It's not possible. Not technically. The microchips couldn't fail. That was the entire point. There had been earlier prototypes that had malfunctioned, but the model that had been used for the last 30 years was flawless. There had never been a single recorded incident of error. They were completely tamper-proof, too. Any attempt to surgically remove them would set off an alert. There had been odd groups like the Mercia Collective who had tried to use magic to deactivate them, but by all accounts, it had proved impossible.
You could have reported him to the police.
We could have, Uther agrees. But we decided he'd be more valuable to us if he didn't know we were watching him. I had my suspicions that the information about his chip might come in handy one day.
And you still don't know why it's dead?
Owain takes over the narration at this point again.
No idea. We know his father had ties to the Mercy Collective, but we also know they disbanded before they accomplished anything. So nothing definitive, and we don't know much more from this point on in general. Just bits and pieces. Emrys spent some time in America and Ireland, we think Japan and Norway as well. There are rumors he was involved in the Pittsburgh riots in 2010, but it might just be hearsay. We're almost certain he was in Washington around the time the Magical Surveillance Act was repealed. There's video footage of someone looking a lot like him in the march on the Capitol.
So, when did he come back on your radar?
Last June, he arrived in London and was appointed to be assistant for magical advancement at the Institute. We keep tabs on everyone at the Institute, so I started to file on him right away, and that's when we realized about the missing years.
Owain pushes a typed document across the table to Arthur.
We've been watching him since then, but there's honestly not much to report beyond the nitty-gritty of his daily routine.
He gestures to the printed map on the front page of what Arthur realizes is his new cheat sheet.
He lives in a one-bed flat in Stoke Newington, gets the 76 bus to work, stops for coffee at the White Dragon Cafe next to Rectory Road Station 3 or 4 times a week, and rarely leaves the house on weekends. He visits his mum in Brighton every few weeks, but he doesn't seem to interact socially with anyone else. He's got no online presence, his hard drive is magically protected, and he thoroughly shreds all paperwork before throwing it out.
Owain's usually professional tone has given way to mild frustration, and it almost makes Arthur want to laugh.
This amorous bloke had clearly been leading Owain's team on a merry dance this past year.
"Owain's team have done the legwork for you. I suggest you stake out the area for a few days so you can pick your time,"
Uther interposes briskly, and Arthur's urge to laugh fades. Did his father think he couldn't figure that out by himself?
"He tends to work late most days, and his flat is down a deserted side street,"
Owain adds helpfully. Like Arthur's such a fucking idiot, he might just stride up to Emrys in broad daylight and clonk him over the head.
Arthur bites back a sharp retort and instead nods at Owain. It's not his fault that everyone at Arkstone thinks Arthur some kind of clueless moron. He hasn't exactly done much to prove them wrong over the years.
"Right, hardware," Owain says, turning businesslike. "Here's your ankle tag, standard police issue magic suppressor, but with a few modifications from the boys in the lab. Not only will it cage his magic, it'll make him untraceable by magical means. No amount of scrying spells will find him when you've locked this one."
"Useful," Arthur comments. It looks like a chunky black bracelet, vaguely resembling the kind of thing people with Aspos were ordered to wear.
"But that's not the best part." Owain twirls it in his hand, like a door-to-door seller honing in on a sale. "It's got an inbuilt memory wipe. When you take this off, everything that's happened from the moment you first put it on will be completely erased from the wearer's consciousness. Knock him out when we're done, take it off, and leave. He won't be able to remember a thing that happened."
Arthur blanches.
"That's..." He pauses, picking his words carefully. "That sounds like magic."
"Because it is," Uther intones, and Arthur looks at him in shock.
"Don't look so dumbfounded, Arthur. The labs have long taken advantage of the resources available to them. We might fight for the full elimination of magic, but we can also recognize times when winning that fight means using magic to our advantage."
"But we can't."
"Arthur, I have to get back to the fifth floor in 10 minutes. Do you mind if you wrap this up? I'd be happy to answer any tech questions you have by email."
Owain's tone is polite, but Arthur feels the rebuke in it anyway.
Right, he says. "But, if he sees me before I get the device on..."
"You'll be lying low anyway for a while once this job is done. In the unlikely event he remembers you, you'll be out of the picture,"
Uther says briskly. Then he favors Arthur with an odd look.
"I thought perhaps you could go and spend some time in South America. Brush up on your Spanish. That was your plan once, wasn't it?"
The look on Uther's face is almost indulgent, and Arthur's heart leaps slightly. The fact that his father's even referring to his old degree, with a half-smile on his face no less, is unprecedented. Arthur reads the meaning behind it loud and clear. If he pulls this off, the slate's wiped clean, he can finally be forgiven. Not only forgiven, but released from his contract at Arkstone too, free to finally try and make something of himself on his own terms. With his father's blessing this time, rather than going behind his back.
Arthur can't quite believe it can be that simple.
"Won't you need me here?"
"We'll do without you for a year or two," Uther says lazily. "Be good for you to expand your horizons a little."
A year or two? It may as well be a lifetime from Uther's perspective. His father's never made such concessions before.
Arthur nods, suddenly elated, and turns his attention back to Owain.
"Lovely, okay, so I'll give you the device and the key that opens it."
Owain hands the items across the table.
"Make getting that on him your first priority," Owain warns. "We have no current data on how powerful this guy is, so you don't want to take any chances."
"However," Uther says, "his original assessment put him at below average level. He might have learned a few new tricks on his travels, but I don't foresee him being much of a threat."
Owain takes out a little silver briefcase, opening it to reveal 2 syringes and a few medicine bottles. "Sedatives, in case you need to keep him quiet. We'll be giving you a van to transport him in. It's fully soundproofed. Take your medkit with you as well. Better to be safe than sorry."
Uther had trained Arthur always to have a full medical kit on hand, complete with disinfectant, painkillers of varying strength, and all the first aid basics, nestled alongside tools to stitch knife wounds or remove bullets.
The house in the moors is already equipped with most of the other things he needs, handcuffs and rope and other essentials. This Emrys isn't the first to be detained there, but it'll be the first time Arthur will be in charge. The thought makes him both proud and queasy. He's waited 7 years for his father to entrust him with something real, and now it's finally happened, and he's nervous. What if something goes wrong? What if he screws up? What if Emrys escapes or overpowers him? He decides to set those worries aside and concentrate on the next few days. He knows he's good at this bit, good at surveillance and planning and learning a person's routine. He's not even that concerned about the actual kidnapping itself. He just has to focus and take it all one step at a time.